Good morning, everyone. I attempted to contact Rabbi Breidowitz to find out what he would have said, but the line was busy. So I'm going to say what I want to say. One of the more interesting quirks in our understanding of the Messianic era and the Messiah itself is that in the Torah itself, in the Chamisha Chumshei Torah, there is no reference to the Messiah. There's a reference to the fact that Be'achrit Hayomim, at the end of days, after all these things happen to you, and all of Jewish history plays itself out, Rishov Hashem Elokecha, Shvuscha, Rechamecha, God will have mercy upon us, He will return us to our land, Ve'itivecha, it will be good for you, it will be better than it ever was, but there is no reference to a person. There is no reference to a Messiah. In the Nevi'im, which we're going fast forward 1,000 years, there is reference to a person. Now, there's a difference of opinion in the Mefarshim, whether even in the Nevi'im the reference is to a person. For instance, the famous Perek in Yeshayahu, the Haftorah that we read, V'yotzochoter, V'geza Yishai, there'll come forth a shoot from the trunk of the family of Yishai, and that he will be Lamar Be'amisra, Shalom Ein Keitz, he'll be the greatest. Now, most of them are Farshim, and Rashi emphasizes it, that we're talking about Chizkiyo HaMelech, we're not talking about any sort of later Messiah. Now, it could be that Rashi and the Mefarshim were influenced by the fact that this became one of the major chapters in Tanakh that the Christians took and distorted to make it appear as though it prophesies the Christian Savior. Yes. But again, and it does not give him supernatural powers, even if we say we're talking about a Melech HaMashiach, it does not give him any supernatural powers. Be a tzaddik. Now the Gemara says, Bikesh, they wanted in heaven that Chizkiyo should be the Mashiach. But it didn't happen for various reasons. And so that's an allusion to the fact that the prophecy is regarding Chizkiyo HaMelech, but that he did not fulfill the dream for whatever reason. So we have a very vague concept of Mashiach, certainly in Second Temple times, because in Second Temple times we had the Beit HaMikdash, we had for a long period of time an independent Jewish state, and so the idea of Mashiach was, let's say, put on back burner. At the end of Second Temple times, when Herod already represented Rome and ruled over Judea, so the Talmud tells us that all the Chachomim knew that the temple was going to be destroyed, that it was only a question of time, it was irreversible, because of the behavior of the Jewish people. And therefore, the idea of getting past the destruction of the temple and the rebuilding of the temple took hold. And it's at this time that, for instance, the prophecies of the Novi Yecheskel, who lived after the first temple was destroyed. So he describes a construction of a temple, and he describes the dimensions and how it would look, etc. And the second temple did not resemble that at all. So therefore, because of this prophecy, so it was obvious that he's talking about a third temple. Well, a third temple can only occur if somehow the second temple is destroyed, the Jewish people will go into exile, and then they will be redeemed again. But even in the Novi Yecheskel, he does not speak of a person as a Mashiach. He speaks about an era. He speaks about a Nosi. That's our synagogue is named after that. But he does not speak about a king that will redeem us, etc. The temple is destroyed. The second temple is destroyed. Now, at the end of the second temple, we have the first and perhaps greatest. Greatest is the wrong word, but most important, most damaging of the false messiahs, that we have the rise of Christianity. And Christianity saw in Jesus the Messiah. And then the question arose that he was executed by the Romans. And he was rejected by the Jews. So you have here a rejected Messiah and a dead Messiah. So what do we do with him? How do we deal with that? So in Christian theology advanced him from being the Messiah to being, whatever that means, the Son of God. It's part of the Trinity. He's not really a human being. He sits at the right hand of God. And he lived at a time of great disputes about, Mel Gibson's movie. We don't have a handle on it. The rabbis really didn't speak about it. The Talmud really doesn't devote much space to it. He lived at a time when there was messianic fervor. There were all sorts of groups within the Jewish people. Today we call them political parties. But there were all sorts of groups who had all sorts of ideas. And most of the groups were not within the mainstream of Jewish tradition. They were looking for, the Jews were always looking for something magical. Something that, that'll take us out of our ordinary mundane world and allow us to be in a utopian, perfect world. And Christianity was that. there's peace and brotherhood and, you know, prosperity. Was that, it's going to be great. Could be greater. And to make it even greater, we're going to do away with a lot of the ritual and the small minutiae of Judaism that makes being a Jew a challenging event. So within the first century of Christianity, they did away with almost all of Jewish ritual, and they became a universal religion, not a religion for the Jews, but a religion for all of mankind. And the divinity of the Christian Savior was essential. And they acquired the bad habit of being an exclusive religion, and if you don't believe like them, then you were going to be persecuted. So that was the first false messiah. And the Jews chafed under Roman rule. The temple was destroyed in 70. 65 years later, Bar Kokhba arose, and he was a national hero, and he said that he would rebuild the temple. Now, the ruins of the temple still existed, and Jews prayed on the Temple Mount. The Romans allowed that. That he said he was going to rebuild the temple and that he was going to get rid of the Romans. And he mounted an army and a revolution, and he had backing. He had backing of great people. Rabbi Akiva thought and advertised Bar Kokhba as being the Mashiach. So the definition of the Mashiach was that he was going to get rid of foreign rule, that he was going to rebuild the temple. And Rabbi Akiva suffered greatly because the rabbis did not follow his lead. Rabbi Tarfon said to him, Rabbi Tarfon was his chavrusa, so to speak. They marched together throughout the Mishnah. He said, Akiva, Esev yale belachayayich, grass will grow from your cheeks, ve'ein ben David bo, and the Mashiach is not here. And so it happened, because Bar Kokhba turned out to be a false Mashiach. The Romans defeated him. In his frustration, he turned against many of his Jewish supporters. He executed the rabbis who disagreed with him. He became a tyrant. The rabbis called him Bar Kuziva, which was a play on his original words, the name. Kokhva meant star, Dorach Kokhov Miyakov. And Kuziva means falsehood. He said that he was false. He was a false messiah. And after he was killed, and the revolution failed. The Romans then plowed under the temple, the mountain. They lowered the mountain, and they renamed the city of Jerusalem Isla Capitolina, no longer to be called Jerusalem. and the Jewish people went into exile. Tens of thousands of Jews were taken as slaves to Rome. The Jews built the Colosseum. I always find it interesting that Jews go, you know, we have plenty of places in Europe to go to say Kaddish, right? There are tours, I call them the Kaddish tours. You know, when you're an old man like me, you can say what you want. Because it doesn't make any difference. I can never understand why people are going anywhere. You want to go see natural wonders? You want to go see the British Museum? You want to see the White House? So do I. But why do I want to go to these places? Why do I want to see them? Why do I want to give those countries' economy a boost? So anyway, if you go to the Colosseum, you should say Kaddish there. At least 50,000 Jews died building the Colosseum. But I didn't say that. So we have the Jewish people in exile. Christianity takes over the Western world. Both the Byzantine Christians and the Roman Catholic Christians are bitterly anti-Semitic. The early church fathers said terrible things about us, which remain in circulation until today. And they were terribly frustrated because the people of the Messiah didn't hold him to be the Messiah. If he comes back, you know, he's not going to speak Latin. He's going to speak Hebrew. Who's going to understand him? In fact, they had to develop a whole theory called the Pope's Jews. That the reason the Jewish people, that we have to keep the Jewish people around, we can't destroy them completely, is because when Jesus will return, he can only speak to the Jews. And, you know, there are no Jews around, you know. He doesn't have an Irish accent. How's he going to talk to anybody? On such weird ideas. But our world is built on weird ideas. Built on weird people. You know, the man said, it takes all kind of people to make up this world, and I'm glad I'm not one of them. So we go to a period, it's the Dark Ages, it's called in general history. In Jewish history, it's also pretty dark. So the idea then of redemption, of that somehow the Jewish people will get out of this persecution, will somehow be restored to their homeland, will no longer be scattered throughout the world. That took root in Jewish thought and in Jewish life because to a great extent that's all the Jewish people had. That was our hope. Well, how else are we going to... Otherwise it's useless. If we're never going to get out of this, if it's never going to be better, if we're never going to be the Jewish people, so it's useless. So we should give it up. So it was the belief that somehow it would get better and that there would be a way out that fueled Jewish survival throughout the ages. Added to that, the fact that in all of our prayers, we never forgot Zion and Jerusalem. And we always said that the land of Israel belongs to us. and we always said that we were going to return to it. So that created the basis for messianic belief. Now, so Rabbi Breidowitz's discussion with you, I'm just going to allude to it. So what kind of messianic era do we want now? What's it going to look like? So the Talmud already had the opinion of Mar Shmuel, and he said, "Ein bein yemos haMashiach l'olam hazeh, elo shibud malchios bilvad." He portrayed a very bland messianic era. Nothing is going to happen differently. The only difference is that America will stop proposing peace plans. Shibud Malchus, we don't worry about the United Nations anymore. We don't care about that anymore. That's Mashiach. Otherwise, there'll be traffic jams and political parties and economic problems and fights and disputes, and it'll be the fare that we are accustomed to. The Rambam adopts the opinion of Mar Shmuel. The Rambam literally says, Olam k'minhago noeg. The world will be exactly the same the way it is. There's no tchias ameisim by Mashiach. It's two different things. There's no olam abo by Mashiach. It's two different things. There's no utopia. There's no perfect world. There's Jewish independence. And the fact that the fate of the Jewish people will not be in the hands of foreign nations. Now, in the time of the Rambam already, there were a number of false messiahs. The Rambam writes about it. There was a false messiah in Yemen, and there was a false messiah in Iraq. Because now you had the rise of Islam. And Muhammad was convinced that the Jews would adopt it. Because he said, I understand why they didn't adopt Christianity, because it resembles idolatry. It has its imperfect monotheism. But my religion is perfect monotheism. I'm not the son of God, I'm just the prophet. And in our mosques, there are no idols or any physical representations. And we worship the one God of the world. So certainly they're going to buy in. It didn't help that the Rambam called it mentally unbalanced. And it was very, very touch and go for the first 50, 60 years of Islam and the Jewish people. Eventually, Islam became convinced that they were not going to convert the Jews. So they created something that they called Dhimmi. Dhimmi was a second-class citizen. And they said the Jews and the Christians were the people of the book because they still held reverence for the Bible. And that they're entitled to live in an Islamic society, but they're entitled to live there only as second-class citizens. So they'll have to get off the sidewalk when the Muslims walk by. They'll have to have their houses of worship be built low to the ground. They'll have to wear certain clothing. All of that is true. But they're allowed to live. We're not going to kill them. And they're allowed to practice their religion. in these Islamic countries. It didn't happen in the Christian countries, it happened in the Islamic countries. False messiahs arose who promised that they were going to redeem the Jewish people. And whenever anybody is a messiah, claims to be a messiah, he will automatically have followers amongst the Jews. Because we are a people that are always looking for utopia. That's the success of all politicians with the Jews. The more you promise, that's it, he's our guy. We're going to give you everything. And it won't cost you anything, and everything will be wonderful. And we like that. That's messianic. Even though we have no promise from anyone that that's what it's going to look like. In fact, as I pointed out to you from the Talmud and from the Rambam, it seems just the opposite. Okay. Now there are interesting characters that appear in the Jewish world for a change. So there's a man called, in the 12th century, there's a man called Eldad Ahadoni. He says that he is descended from the tribe of Don. That's why he's called Adoni. And he says there's a legend that Jews believed, and it was taught in Jewish schools, that there is a far distant land somewhere behind the magical river, the Sambatyon, and this river throws up stones and fire 6 days a week. On Shabbat it rests. On the other side of that are the 10 tribes of Israel that were exiled. But they can't come to join their brethren because in the middle of the week it's stones and fire, and on Shabbat you're not allowed to go outside the tchum. So here comes this guy, Eldad Ahadoni, and he says somehow he got across the river. And he's from the tribe of Dan. And not only that, he is quoted Lahalocha. The Rosh quotes him. One of his major halachas was that women can be shochtim. We know that women can be shochtim, but I don't think they meant it in that sense. But he's accepted, the Jews accept that there's a guy that came and he says, I'm from the tribe of Dan, and he got across the river, and, you know, and that's it. And in the 15th century, there's a man who calls himself David or Ruveni. He's from the tribe of Ruvain, and he puts on the whole show. He comes with a golden carriage and white horses, and he has an audience with the Pope, and he goes around everywhere, and the Jews don't know, and he doesn't say he's the Messiah, he's the ambassador of the Messiah. He's the PR man. And we will see that the whole history of messiahs amongst the Jewish people, there always has to be a public relations man. Otherwise, it won't go. And we also feel that way because we say Leo has to be the Mavasar Agula, right? So Leo Anovi is the public relations man for the Messiah that's going to come. Anyway, he kept the act going for a few years until one of the dukes in Spain got tired of it and had him arrested, and he died in prison. And it was obvious that he also was someone who took advantage of the naivete of the Jewish people. But it's very hard to speak against this because it supplies hope. It supplies an answer that other people don't have. And especially when Eldad Adoni or David or Ruveni is a Talmud Chacham, is a scholar, and an observant and pious Jew. So, the response to stand up and say, no, it's a fake, you'll get pilloried for doing that. Yeah, no one will join you. So it has to collapse by itself. In the 1648 and 1492 was the expulsion from Spain, which in its day was the Holocaust of its time. Then, in 1648 and 1649, in the Ukraine and Poland and parts of Lithuania, Bogdan Khmelnytsky led a rebellion against the Polish landlords, but on the way he killed about 200,000 Jews. And in the good old days, he had to kill everybody by hand. There was no, there were no gas chambers. Auschwitz could do 10,000 a day. In the good old days, you had to do it by hand. So by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you were tired. So when we talk, he only killed, 10,000, 20,000. You don't realize what it took to kill 10, 20,000. And so, you have these disasters, one after another. Like in every century, there's a new Holocaust. And the Jewish people got tired. There already are stirrings in the 17th century that somehow we're not going to be able to continue this way. There must be a solution. Well, then, in Smyrna, Turkey, there arises a person, Shabsai Tzvi, who is a genius. He was well known as a great scholar in Torah. And there's an exhaustive biography of him by Professor Gershon Scholem from the Hebrew University. And Scholem thinks that the whole problem was because of the rise of Kabbalah. There's no question that Kabbalah played a role in it, because Kabbalah already removed the Jewish world from the reality of this world into a different world. And in that world, the Messiah really takes precedence. But I think he may have overstated the case, but in any event, Shabsai Tzvi is enormously successful. He's successful because he has the great public relations man, Nathan of Gaza. Nathan of Gaza was a genius in publicizing Shabsai Tzvi. And within a year, the entire Jewish world is fascinated by him. And he says he's the Messiah and he's going to do it. And he has backing from, they estimate that at least 30% of the Jewish people believed in him. And he had many great rabbis that believed in him. I hate to tell you this, but rabbis are not infallible. Sometimes great people make great mistakes. So, for instance, in Eastern Europe, the Taz of David Halevi Segel, who wrote the great commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, and whose commentary is studied until today as one of the basic books of Ashkenazic halacha. So he sent two of his stepsons to see Shabtai Tzvi. And the Taz then was an elderly person already. He was weak. And Shabtai Tzvi sent back with the sons an overcoat. And he told them if he would wear it, he would his youth and energy would be restored. You know, there's all the physicians are aware that there's something called the placebo effect. You go to the doctor and you don't feel well, the doctor gives you a prescription for a pill that's made out of sugar and flour. It has no medicinal benefit whatsoever. And you take the pill and you say, gee, I feel better. And people do feel better. Many a drug industry creation has never been able to get federal approval simply because the people who took the drug, it's a blind test, so 50% take the drug and 50% take a placebo. So the 50% who took the drug got better, but the 50% who took the placebo also got better. So you put on the overcoat, you feel better. He tells you you're going to feel better, you can feel better. And they were master manipulators, Shabtai Tzvi and Nathan of God. And then it became a matter of money. Now that you always have to know. The connection of money to religion is always lethal. So like you, if you wanted an interview with Shabtai Tzvi, you know, you had to pay off. You had to pay the gabbai, you had to pay the guy on the outside, and you had to leave him a donation for all of his charitable works. So it became an industry. And he overstepped, you know, the part of the fate of a faker is eventually the faker believes the fake. That's the punishment. What the Talmud says. The punishment of a liar is that he believes his lies. So after a while, he really thought that he's the Messiah. He thought that somehow he had all of this ability. So he started doing strange things which were against halacha. So for instance, he canceled Tisha B'Av. Because we don't need Tisha B'Av anymore because the Messiah is here. And he said everybody should have a feast on Tisha B'Av because it says that the fast will be a day of rejoicing and a feasting. So that started to raise flags already that somehow, And then, he married a 12-year-old girl.
A what?
There are such things in the world. And it did other things that were very, very... And Sholem believes him to be a manic depressive. If it would be in our time to be diagnosed by a mental health therapist, that's what they would say, because he could go days without sleeping, and then he would withdraw for days and not be around at all. So they attributed all of that to his great spiritual powers. Eventually, so what happened was that, for instance, in the records of the Dutch East India Company, so they had their ships in the port of Amsterdam in Holland, and they brought spices to Europe from the Dutch islands in the Pacific, what is today Indonesia, and they brought spices from the Caribbean. And they owned all of these ships. The Jews leased the ships because they're going back to the land of Israel. Everybody wanted to have, you know, first class cabin. And it says that, you know, that they almost went out of business because they didn't have any ships. The Jews had leased all the ships. And it made a tremendous tumult in Europe amongst the non-Jews. And the diplomatic pouches of the time are full of it. And in many communities, the Jews stood up and they violently punished those who had persecuted them. And they felt that they could get away with it because the Messiah had come. So we're not talking here about just theory. And this naturally shook the church to its foundations and frightened the Muslims as well. So the Sultan of Turkey decided he was going to put a stop to all of this. And he had Şahsi III arrested, and he put him in really under house arrest in a palace in Turkey. Now here, Nathan of Gaza says, this is the moment that we're going to separate the true believers from those that aren't. And that now is when you have to believe, because now it's a challenge to believe. But the true believers will remain loyal. And they did. And they kept on coming to visit the Şahsi III and bring him money, etc. And the Sultan tired of the whole act. And he took Şahsi III and he said to him, listen, either you convert to Islam or I will kill you. And Şahsi III converted to Islam. And he had a job in the court of the Sultan. He never went back and died 10, 12 years later. When that happened, the Jewish world fell apart. The Messiah converted to Islam. Jews had died throughout the Middle Ages not to convert. Simple Jews, plain Jews, and here the Messiah. And that debacle, to a great extent, still reverberates till our time, because it changed all of Jewish history. And I believe that much of what we see in the world today, Jewish world, is a reflection of still the reaction to that. So for so for instance, after Shabbos Tzvi, the Haskalah and secularism arises, and ultimately reform. And it arises in Europe. And basically it says, we don't believe in the Messiah anymore. There's no such thing. We're never going back to the land of Israel. And the famous phrase, Berlin is our Jerusalem. It's over. Kuchol ha-goyim beis Yisrael. We're like everybody else, that's all. No chosen people. Forget all that nonsense. And we will have our weekly services on Sunday and not on Saturday. And we can eat whatever food we want to eat, like the rest of the world eats. It's all over. It's one reaction, and that reaction is obvious to all today as well. It's much more complicated today because so much has happened to us over the last 200 years. But basically, that reaction is there. Then you had a second reaction within the observant Jewish world, and that was the rise of Hasidus. Hasidus, to a great extent, said, forget about the rabbis. Prayer is more important than scholarship. I'm going to concentrate on good deeds. We're going to observe the Torah. But we say that the world that we live in is not the real world. The real world is a spiritual world. That's the real world. And there are holy people who are in contact with that real world. And that in order for me to have a connection to that real world, I have to have a connection to those real people who have that connection. The tzaddik, the Rebbe. And so amongst Hasidim, till today, every Rebbe is the potential Messiah because he has the connection to the real world. Now the Gaon of Vilna said that was wrong. The real world is the real world. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said, I think the best one sentence definition of reform when he created the Musar movement. So he said that reform came to change Judaism. And he said, and I have come to change Jews. And the truth of the matter is that everything that has happened in 200 years has been to change Judaism, to redefine it, to make it more acceptable in current society. So, for instance, in the United States, for at least 75% of American Jews, Judaism is the platform of the Democratic Party. That's the definition of Judaism. So they changed Judaism. Here in Israel, it's much more complex. And then there was a third reaction. And the third reaction was that we're not going to wait for the Messiah. We don't need a Messiah. We can do it ourselves. It's Leo Pinsker's famous book, Auto-Emancipation. Free ourselves. I once lectured in a yeshiva about auto-emancipation, and they said, well, what are we going to do without our automobiles? What are we going to do without our automobiles? But I don't think he had that in mind. We're going to do it ourselves. We're going to go back to Israel ourselves. We're going to make a state ourselves. We're going to make an army. We're going to do it ourselves, which was basically the idea of political Zionism. So political Zionism was the secular Messiah. No Mashiach, per se, but the ideas of the Mashiach we will fulfill. We'll bring the Jews back to the land of Israel, and we will establish a Jewish independent state, and we're going to try and build the utopia in this country that we're going to have. And for instance, Rabbi Reines, who was the founder and the head of the Mizrahi, and the Mizrahi was the religious Zionists, he went out of his way, and the Mizrahi always went out of its way saying that we're building a state to be able to save Jews. This is not the Messianic era. We're not dealing with Mashiach. But no matter what you say, the perception of how people saw it was far different. And that is what occasioned, there's a lot of reasons for the opposition to Zionism in the Orthodox community. Opposition which still exists today to a great extent, both here in Israel, certainly in the United States. It's not just Satmar. It's very pervasive. Why don't they want to say the prayer for the state of Israel? Why is that worse than saying the prayer for President Trump? Or for Theresa May? Or the Queen or whoever, you know? Because you're, by saying it, you're saying that somehow this may be the beginning of the Messianic era. So we say, Rav Herzog, when he composed the prayer, he said, Reishis Tzmichas Gulatzeinu. He qualified it. Reishis is just the beginning, Tzmichas of the growth of Gulaseinu, of our redemption, and then he included in it that he should send to us the Mashiach to be able to do it. And that was an attempt somehow to bridge what basically is not easily bridged. So many of the early opponents of Herzl, aside from the secularism, and aside from the fact that later Zionism, political Zionism, was hijacked by the socialists and the left. But aside from all of that, the problem was, here we go again. Are we going to invest ourselves in something that, God forbid, may turn out to be illusory, unsuccessful? We're going to have a false messianic era. something that really Jewish people can't bear anymore. And then you'll add to it the fact that no one foresaw the Holocaust, even though it was predicted in the Torah. But no one foresaw it. No one realized its effect. So the state had to arise, because otherwise the Jewish people would really have been gone. I remember it from my youth. I was in the yeshiva in 1946, 47, 48. No, the Jewish people were non-existent. We had no hope. England is blockading here. You got 250,000 survivors in Europe that have nowhere to go. You got 30,000 Jews in prison camps in Cyprus. Every day they're blowing up buildings in Jerusalem. In the United States, you couldn't get into Harvard or Yale. You couldn't get into a medical school. You don't realize what Dr. Belkin did when he created Albert Einstein Medical School. Nobody wore a yarmulke in the street. I remember when I applied for the bar exam, so they asked naturally your names. I gave them my name. They said, why don't you call yourself Bernard? Because how could you go through life not calling yourself Bernard, but Beryl? And that was accepted by us. We knew that was the way it was going to be. So what happened was like a 180-degree change. So then how do we view this thing? I don't know. I enjoy every minute, but I don't know what it is. Mazos oso Hashem vanu. What has God done for us here? And we're in the midst of trying to find out. But we have so much baggage from the exile. So much experience and history that to a great extent we're still afraid to commit. We're afraid to say that somehow maybe this is the beginning of the good things. But, I find it very interesting that Jews from the United States or from France or England buy apartments here in Jerusalem as an insurance policy. And Jews from Israel get Polish passports as an insurance policy. Because no one feels secure. No one feels that this is what's going to be. I wonder that, like my taxi driver gets me at China over and over again, the troubles that he has to prove that he was born in Poland, that his grandmother was born in Poland, and he's got to have. I said, what do you need a Polish passport for? He said, but what do you mean, Indian? You have to have another passport. I think that's what the Rambam meant, that the Messianic era is when we will feel that we don't need another passport. And there'll be a sense of security that exists within the Jewish world and within Jews individually. So I know that you're suffering from the trauma that Rabbi Reiterwitz was not here this week.
What about Chabad?
Rav Kook was not a messianist. And Rav Kook did not see Zionism as the Messiah. He had a different view. They had a different view of things. You know, there's a lot of gray area here. There's a lot of room for a lot of opinions. And the best thing is that the Lord should give us years and we'll wait and see what happens and enjoy every minute. And more than that, it can't be. Mrs. Friedwald has prepared wonderful refreshments for you.
Don't overdo it. Thank you, Rabbi Wein. It was wonderful.